Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to bicker about in the interim. You can call us toll-free at, from the United States, 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada, 888-810-8322, or you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archives. Now, my own blog is How the Neocons Stole Freedom. Blogging is what keeps many of us sane in these days of economic and political turmoil. My blog this week is pure political satire. It takes on the still embattled issue of placing the Bush Library and Policy Center at SMU, and projects the intellectual content of this presidency and its demonstrated policies into fantasy land, producing Bushland, a small attraction that sort of illustrates where the Bush policy might take you. It is intended to spark your creativity. So imagine your own Bushland attractions for a future we all hope to avoid. Now, some people said it was sort of macabre, but hey, that's what I had to work with. And now an update on the Bush Library. As we discovered last week, the residents of the area known as the Bubble, because they cheerfully ignore what goes on any place but what has become known to be the Park Cities, finally discovered that many people are extremely annoyed with President Bush, and some of those people may be terrorists. So locating his new home, now being built on Euclid and Cheney a couple of blocks away along with the Library and Policy Center and most of his best chums who live right there in Highland Park, has deemed to be perhaps questionable by some of the local residents. Those people who have supported Bush and wanted the library there are now beginning to have questions. The local residents actually were very supportive, and they were even arranging cookie baking contests until the idea of terrorism suddenly did intrude. That subject has electrified them, and the idea that the Bubble might be a terrorist target has caused pause for thought. Now, if you look for my next article, which will be titled Bringing the War Home, the Bubble Pops in Texas, we'll go into more of the details. Now, personally, I don't think the terrorists would be likely to think Bush was worth the trouble. And personally, I would rather see he and his friends confined to working at Walmart without health care for the rest of their lives. But then I have a forgiving nature. And now some comments on the events we are following that are still in motion. On the equal rights front, plans continue to ratify now. Those plans include some very interesting revelations on arch, if aging, neocon operative Phyllis Schlafly. So stay tuned for that. It's coming soon. And now our thought for the week ahead. Today, the Wall Street Journal added Jim Gibbons, the present and newly elected governor of Nevada, on charges of corruption. At the same time in Alaska, the following news report came out today by Amanda Bowman and Chris Esselman, staff writers. Former Fairbanks Mayor Jim Hayes and his wife pleaded not guilty in federal court Friday to charges they steered almost $500,000 in federal grant money toward personal expenses and to help build and operate a church at which Hayes is pastor. Of course, both are Republicans. One is an accident. to speak ominously of Roe v. Wade's positioning for purposes not yet evidenced. While many of us certainly knew the level of ethics functioning in the world of neoconism, these well-publicized outings of individuals may stem from a different cause. It's Friday today. The Gibbons story, originally published by the Wall Street Journal, is interesting because it gives the appearance of a handy, sacrificial victim arching off the back of the sleigh into the drooling maw of the wolves. Having to appear in the Wall Street Journal means the sources may never be known, since that publication is well known as an organ for neoconism. Throwing up a screen of publicity in an entirely different direction is a long-term tool of the neocon public relations people now doing duty for their corporate employers. If that is the case, we can expect something very big this President's Day weekend. It could be the long-impending attack on Iran, or it could be a flanking move for taking over the SMU campus in its entirety so that a larger golf course is available for Bush Jr. when he moves his operation to the bubble. I suggest you keep your eyes on the news this weekend. It promises to be interesting, if not frightening. And about the SMU petition drives on the threatened takeover by Bush and his buddies. As you remember, two petition drives, one supporting the Bush Library and the other opposing it, are now garnering signatures. Peruse these. They tell their own story, and the links are available through my blog. Last week, I read a letter written by one poster opposing the library. Here's another one just posted from Shirley C. Gregham. Christ Church United Methodist, Troy, New York. I believe the actions of this president have been uniformly contrary to the teachings of Christ and completely inconsistent with Methodist principles of social justice, care and compassion for the needy, and peacemaking. In my view, Southern Methodist University needs to make a choice between continuing to call itself Methodist and hope to hosting the library. At the time the petitions pro and con against the incursion of the Bush Library and Policy Center at SMU continue to draw public attention. At the start of the show today, the total of these stood at 122 supporting the Bush Library and Policy Center, 10,586 against the Bush Library Project. When you look over the petitions, you will see that the literacy level of those against the library continues to be higher than those who support it. This is doubtless viewed with suspicions by those who support No Child Left Behind. I received a rather nasty email from a Mark Finn who seemed to be dedicated to spewing nastiness. I do not know Mr. Finn, but the kind of tirade he emits reminds me of a dozen of the Freepers who insisted that John Fund was a model of decorum and good behavior. One can only stand so much. Mr. Finn will doubtless keep insisting I am a scary liberal. Freedom of speech gives people a right to speak silliness on their own dime. By the actions, you will know them. Now, actions always speak our truth, allowing us to be known for what we really are, eventually. Rhetoric is so easily used to lie. The prosperous history of so many con artists testifies to the truth of that. Lying allows individuals to persuade others to consent to thievery. Those involved in politics today don't seem to see anything wrong with acquiring money and power under false pretenses. What to do about that nasty human tendency raises questions that all Americans need to confront. Our speaker tonight is an officer of the Republican Liberty Caucus, a group internal to the Republican Party that has set itself the job of acting as a conscience for that ethically beleaguered group. Many Republicans who remain firmly committed to the ideas of small government, local control, and personal autonomy for every individual have been horrified at what they see unfolding. Those are concerns shared by our speaker. Doug Lorenz founded the computer consulting firm Lorenz Technologies in 1990. With offices in San Francisco and Sunnyvale, he provided network solutions and computer systems to companies throughout the Bay Area. As the Internet began to grow as a business and communications tool, Douglas returned to college to update his focus. After college, he broadened his life mission and today works for the political consulting firm Russo, Marsh & Rogers in 2000 and developed the company's current information technologies capabilities. Subsequently, during Bill Simon's campaign for governor of California, Douglas served as the campaign's director of information technologies and designed the campaign's mobile war room capabilities, allowing campaign staff to stay connected to the main office during remote activities such as conventions and political debates. His concerns and personal beliefs drew him into membership in the RLC. Loren says we must begin a dialogue that goes beyond rhetoric and into the hearts of all Americans, bringing us together. That was the original idea. Please welcome Doug Lorenz. Doug, are you there?
Yes, thanks a lot for having me, Melinda.
Well, I'm so glad that you could be with us because we have so many exciting, interesting things to talk about. Now, we always begin by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves, not already in evidence. So this is your opportunity to tell us about Doug.
Oh, geez. You covered most of the and the generic stuff that I've known for there. For the most part, I am a political consultant in Sacramento. I've worked with a number of political organizations and campaigns, so I see the way different people and different organizations approach politics. Primarily, I work on Republican political campaigns, but I've been part of other ones as well. I've worked with a couple of nonpartisans as well as some libertarian efforts. But with political consultants, we tend to stay within one party, and it's been a little difficult. And I still identify as a Republican. I've always been a Republican, and ideologically, I have a lot of libertarian leanings, and I feel very passionate about a lot of that. But really, I don't think I'm any more big L libertarian than some of our greatest Republicans, notably Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater, who have clearly come from that side of the party. And that's been my focus throughout much of my my politically active life. And that's been what the organizations that I've been a part of have really been espousing. For myself, it's just been a matter of trying to get other people active in these politics and just get discussions going. There really isn't a lot else to myself. I do enjoy, I do participate in education issues. My wife is a teacher, and that's always been a big thing for me. But it's when you get into politics and when you spend a lot of time working in politics, you'll find that the vast majority of the people that are involved end up having very little of what we would normally consider a social life.
Politics becomes your social life. That's what happens.
Exactly. We all become these deformed little creatures that live, eat, and breathe politics. And to some extent, that's what I have chosen to become.
Mm-hmm. Well, but what that means is you're on mission. And that's certainly one of the things I think that is impressive about the Republican Liberty Caucus. I mean, for a group internal to the Republican Party today to say that it's the conscience of the Republican Party, that's a real interesting charge to have undertaken.
Well, yeah, and part of the reason for that is the Republican Party has in the past been the party of opportunity, fighting for individual rights and limited government. However, I think most of your listeners will note that over the past decade, we've watched the Republican Party change its tune and really become and change from the party of opportunity to become more of the party of opportunists. We've seen our political leaders using their clout to offer payoffs to their contributors. And obviously, people in San Diego see that quite clearly in Randy Duke Cunningham. And over the past few days, they've seen the indictments of some of Cunningham's people, notably Brent Wilkins, the guy that that owned a defense contracting firm that was buying these contracts with political favors to the the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican Liberty Caucus is passionately opposed to the graft and corruption that have really taken ownership of the national GOP. I guess it can best be put that the RLC is about fighting for a smaller and less intrusive form of government.
Mm-hmm.
This generally means that our economic issues are more conservative in many cases from that of the GOP politicians who identify themselves as conservatives. On social issues, the Republican Liberty Caucus tends to ask the question, is this really something that government should be regulating? And as such, I believe that we're consistent in our ideology, really believing in getting the government out of people's lives. That's the Reagan-Goldwater wing of the Republican Party.
Right. You mean out of the bank account and out of the bedroom.
Exactly. It's just the fact is that the vast majority of the things that are that are going on in people's lives and in this country in general, the people know how to do it, and they don't really need the government to be in there saying, here's how. And yes, there are certain things, there are safety nets, there are certain things that that the government needs to be doing, like defense. That's a very good example. Some people would say that there's government roles in education. But across the board, I mean, we have gotten more and more, our government has gotten more and more focused on identifying all these things that they can do for the people without stopping to ask if they should.
Well, is it whether they can do for the people or to the people?
They
believe
for.
You take a look at each of these things, what you're talking about is people, you know, the government deciding they want to use it as a profit center but not necessarily deliver the product.
Certainly. And I'm the difference I've seen between and recently between Republicans and Democrats, you've got to hand it to the Democrats because while they're passionate about all these things they want to take over government to do, they actually believe that they're trying to help people in most cases, while the Republicans have abandoned their previous ideology of allowing the people to help themselves and providing the tools for that. They've become something that's far different. In abandoning their ideology, they've become just about what they can take out of government.
Mm-hmm.
And that ideology across the board is dangerous.
Very, very dangerous. Tell us a little about the history and goals of the RLC, because it's been around for over 10 years and most people haven't heard of it.
It's actually, the structure is even older than that. It came derived by some individuals from a previous organization called the Libertarian Republican Organizing Committee. And as that didn't go very far, individuals that were involved in that went and formed the Republican Liberty Caucus. One of the main leaders that everybody can recognize from the Republican Liberty Caucus was Ron Paul. He's been the figurehead, and he's been a leader in the organization. And he's also been a candidate for president as a Libertarian, and now he's a candidate for president as a Republican, even though the media refuses to notice.
Mm-hmm.
The organization has had its ups and downs. We are currently, the organization is at a national level, has established chapters in every state. We have people organizing in every state and are trying to build the organization back up. Really, the first step for that is to establish the dialogue, because as you've seen over the past decade, really, much of the issues that the Republican Liberty Caucus is most passionate about, most dedicated to, have been taken out of the lexicon of Republican speak.
Mm-hmm.
And the issues, the types of things you'd expect to have heard from Reagan, just aren't discussed anymore. And that is really the first step of what we're trying to get going again, is to get the discussion going so that we can get people to realize that, hey, that's still a part of the discussion, that's still something that people believe in, and that's still something that's worth trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has been a difficult time for limited government Republicans, but we're starting to see an opportunity now.
Well, tell us more. Tell us about the opportunity that you see, because certainly there needs to be discussion of what's happened with this administration and the neocons. So you're saying that that's going on?
Yes. What has really happened is that this administration, the Bush administration, has developed this top-down policy structure where they don't listen anymore to the activists. What they've done is they've basically set the ideas and expected the Republican activists to just follow along, and for the most part, they've done so. So we've seen Republicans who, under Clinton, went absolutely nuts about Hillary's health care, didn't jump up and scream when Bush said quite similar ideas in his Medicare prescription drug giveaway. We've seen the soul of the Republican Party being put in chains, and the people just aren't passionate about the issues anymore, and instead are simply active for Bush. And I think a large part of this is the war, of course, and this the single issue politics that has taken us off of these general discussions.
Well, a lot of people actually have left the Republican Party now.
Certainly.
And probably what you're seeing is that the people who are ideological and understood the ramifications have left, and the people who are still there are the ones that are more structure-oriented. So they have a loyalty to the organization. They don't think about that it being a vehicle for the ideas.
Actually, we are seeing even those people starting to break away. It's been the Republican leadership in the National Party and in the Bush administration has been so controlling that there's been a fear of breaking away, a fear of criticizing the Republican Party because they come down on you very, very hard. But over the past few months, since November, really, more and more Republicans have been willing to speak out. And as people have started to see a few Republicans making their voices heard about their displeasure about things that the Bush White House has done, that's been giving that opening for the rest of the Republicans to come out and say, you know, I feel the same way. I just didn't know if I was able to talk about it. And
So we've been sort of given permission to talk now.
Exactly. And this is only going to grow. And we're seeing this right now in the discussion for what is really nearly a useless discussion, a non-binding resolution that we already know that Bush is going to ignore. But you're seeing Republicans passionately agreeing or passionately disagreeing with the White House on this issue and doing so publicly.
Mm-hmm.
That is the first step.
Well, tell us more about that.
Well, really, as I said, the Republican Party has not been an ideological organ for a while. The best way to put it is that in that search for control, in the search for power, they've given up the fight for the issues that were most important. So the Bush White House convinced all the Republicans that, hey, you've got to stick with us on this issue, and later we'll do the Republican things. Now that Republicans have seen that's not going to happen, they're starting to get more critical, and there's more discussions going on. Now, on the issue of the war, I think that we're starting to see more and more Republicans willing to go against the president on this, and maybe it will change what happens in the course of the war. But more than that, what's more important is that this has created an attitude that Bush can be criticized.
Mm-hmm.
So the little issues that have so frustrated us, the out-of-control spending, for example, is
the
greatest example. You're going to see more and more Republicans get up and say, look, we can't do this anymore. So when Bush goes and says something, now getting back to defense, such as dropping a $100 billion request for more funds, you're going to see Republicans more willing to question that, and that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And even individuals who are supportive of some of the things of the Bush White House, they have to say that this dialogue, while it should have happened a long time ago, and maybe it could have been solved if this dialogue occurred privately, the fact that it is occurring publicly right now is a positive thing for the party.
Well, do you think if there was any chance of it actually happening privately before? I mean, the neocons have been extremely, you can't say that people who are Straussians who believe they have a right to lie to achieve their goals, I mean, are they going to enter into an effective dialogue?
Not voluntarily, and that's what we've seen. And that's why you're seeing more and more the people that are forcing the dialogue. And this is what happened with the Senate discussion there, is that more than anything else, they wanted to stop the dialogue, and they did. The issue is going to get back to the Senate over the resolution,
mm-hmm.
and maybe they'll force a dialogue. I don't know if that's going to happen, but the fact is that, and it is really sad that it's procedural, but there's now at least a dialogue about the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what it's going to take to convince Republicans that they are free to talk about how they really feel, but we are going in that general direction.
Mm-hmm.
Once this happens, you're going to see more discussion of issues, and the reason why that's important is, really and truly, for the past 6 years, there has been one issue that we have talked about, and it's been the war.
Well, the war and terrorism, the war and terrorism, the war and terrorism.
Yeah.
And everything is justified by that.
Correct. Now that's not the case. That is not going to be the sole issue that drives Republicans. So I see Republicans as being able to talk about other things. And I see at this point now, the Republican Liberty Caucus has its opportunity to stand up and say, okay, here's what we believe. If you believe this, it's time to get involved. It's time to go to the national party, go to the state parties, and try and make a difference again.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps we have an opportunity to bring back the Reagan-Goldwater ideology, because as we've seen it, in the national politicians have not been really passionate about any of those old ideologies for quite a while.
Well, as neocons actually do have an idea. They're ideologues in a sense. They have a set of ideas that they want to impose. They're not ideological in the way we normally use the word. For one, they don't really want a dialogue. What they want to do is impose it, you know, sort of externally. They're very much interested in a very top-down system that doesn't allow for real discussion.
I agree, and clearly we've seen that. It is very much a, almost imperial. The guy on top sets the orders, and maybe he's got a few advisors, but you're not one of them sort of attitudes.
Right. And that must have been kind of shocking, because one of the things that used to be really quite lovely about the Republican Party was the ability for people to disagree and have a meaningful discourse on where we needed to go, what our national direction should be.
Oh, certainly, and I've been a part of a number of those great discussions, and they used to get passionate, and they used to be productive, but I haven't seen that happen in quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in California here, one of the examples has been the California Republican Party. The leadership structure has changed to the point where the power of the party is largely controlled by the national interests. There's some efforts to change that. Part of that is we've moved back our primary to February to try and change it from historically California has been an ATM machine for the politicians, where the national party, where they come here for money, but they use it elsewhere. And largely Republicans recognize that they're not going to win easily in California, so they don't even try to have a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
What they've done is that they've taken a lot of the leadership positions of the Republican Party and changed it to support that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see if it changes. We have a new state chairman for the Republican Party. And
what's
he's
his
guy,
name?
It's Ron Nearing of San Diego. And he has done a great job of building the San Diego Republican Party structure, and it would be really interesting to see if he can do that statewide. But I do have concerns about ideologically where the Republican Party is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
We see similar things here in California with our governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who came in quite ideological, and it didn't take him long to change. Right now, it's impossible to define him as partisan in any way, because he'll do really whatever it takes to be liked.
Well, was he ever ideological, or did he use rhetoric as a way of augmenting a support base?
He was personally ideological, but I think he got slapped down so hard. And what's most important to him is that idea that he wants to be liked and he wants to be accepted. That's very important. And the issues that he came into, he would talk about how he subscribed to the Austrian School of Economics, which to ideological libertarians, that is a code word for I'm one of you.
Right.
But clearly, the bond acts that have been put forth bear no resemblance to the Austrian School of Economics. It's clearly Keynesian.
Well, yes. Which, of course, most people listening probably don't understand the difference between Keynesian economics and an Austrian school. But Austrian school doesn't approve of using policy as a way, you know, the policy manipulation by government. It moves to a true free market.
Right, and the key concept of the Keynesian models is look at all these great things you can do to improve the economy through government intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And much of them have been proven invalid, but people still subscribe to it.
Well, people become sort of addicted to a set of ideas. It becomes almost an extension of their personality and their persona. And they don't want to give it up because that would be painful, I think, personally to them. Also,
correct,
they can become invested in it if they happen to have been promulgating those ideas professionally most of their lives, which many people are now finding themselves in the position where if they really objectively examine what they've been saying, they would have to say this beta test didn't work.
But the problem there is, and we have to look back at the corruption and graft as an example, what happens is that the model does work for the people that that end up in power. Is the and this is part of the neocon model there, is that it's the purpose of power is to maintain power, and it creates itself in their mind. And what they've done is that politically, the political contributions feed them and keep them in power, and they have to basically pay people off. It's the same thing with the politics, as you were talking about, of issues, people becoming addicted to government programs. They start getting things from government, and they think they need it, and they'll start basically paying with their votes the people that are willing to give that.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that the public in general, the individuals, lose their own individual power in that, and what you end up with is you end up with a very small cadre of people that have power and money because of it, and we're all a little bit smaller from
that.
Well,
yes, yeah, so what you're actually creating is an aristocracy, and it's an aristocracy based not on any kind of production or any objective value exchanged consensually, but simply on the ability to manipulate power and coerce other people using the
right
structure of government.
You know, I can accept an aristocracy of people like a Bill Gates, someone who has created something real and tangible. There are a lot of people like that that have created their own or inserted themselves into a new aristocracy. But then, at the same time, there are the people like Brent Wilkes in San Diego, who was just indicted as one of the individuals who bribed Cunningham with money and prostitutes and a bunch of other things for his defense contracting firm.
Mm-hmm.
These people, they don't produce much. In fact, one of the things that Brent Wilkes is known for is I don't remember the exact number. It's a billion and change worth of bottled water for the CIA in Iraq. It was absolutely horrible. The only people that want these things are the defense contractors and the politicians that put them in the budget. The military never asks for them. These are things that just happen for the sole purpose of enriching the power structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and all that money, of course, feeds back into the people in power, who in this particular case are neocons.
Precisely, and this works under a Keynesian economics model, where the belief is that passing this money around through government actually creates growth and creates wealth. But if you do look at it from any other economic model, this is just dead money that doesn't create anything tangible, doesn't help the economy, only takes money from the productive people in society and gives it to a select few who have influence.
Yes, there's an infrastructure that has decided that it needs to use the structure of government as a wealth transfer system so they never have to go get an honest job.
Right. And traditionally, yes, there have always been the, whether we call them neocons or Rockefeller Republicans, there have always been the Republicans that have been addicted to that kind of power. But there have always been also the small government Republicans, and I think now that the neocon side is damaged goods, I think we have an opportunity to reestablish a dialogue and get people to talk about which Republican Party they liked, what Republican Party they want to see taking the reins in a few years.
Well, I think that there was never any doubt that what people liked about the Republican Party was the idea that it was pro-individual rights, pro-small government. So you're looking at government for what it is, which is a tool, an organizational tool, for us. And those people want very much to see a system that delivers justice and responsible personal behavior through the natural selection of people you know, being held accountable for not doing the right thing by the cultural forces that, you know, that exist just naturally in the culture.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody does something they shouldn't do, then people go, well, we're just not going to deal with that person.
Right.
And then you have the accountability of the court system that says you've just created a tort and you're going to be sued and you're going to have to make amends.
I agree. It's the real problem, though, is that we have lost the ability to have that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And within the major media, even I don't know, and maybe I have an idealized view of what the media was like, the old Walter Cronkite days, when the media was thought of as the tool of the people, the protector of the people, that was actually providing information rather than regurgitating rhetoric. But something needs to be done to create that dialogue again. And if it isn't the media, because clearly the 24-hour cable channels, the cable news channels, are not providing us news. They're providing rhetoric. We need to work with people to create something new.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. And the media, I think, has gone through generations of this thing itself. I mean, if you take a look at, you know, the what we call yellow journalism in the first decade of the 20th century, you had Ada Tarbell, who outed the petroleum interests in Standard Oil. And that was a very courageous thing to have done. It made a tremendous difference. It resulted in the anti-monopoly laws. I don't know that that was necessarily the best way to handle the whole issue. And I think that in each case, what you need to take a look at is what tool are you using to deliver what you need in terms of accountability? What's going to really work to extinguish the behavior, make it too expensive for people to continue? Clearly, it didn't work in that particular instance, but she did what she could as a member of the media.
Right. But it's very rare to find members of the media that the public sees as that level of trustworthy. I can't write off think of any right now.
Well,
and perhaps John Stossel, but he's become even a little bit comical at times.
Well, I think the Iconoclast in Texas does that, actually. They come out very consistently with well-researched stories that tell the story, but they're not very big.
Right.
And so they do what they can do. And we need more major media that way.
I certainly agree. I think, though, at the same time, we are going to see less, over the long term, perhaps, less of the major media influence if the web expands much more. The problem there, of course, is that we've seen more and more among the Internet attempts at news, we've seen more and more, I don't know, an ideological, perhaps, and more rhetoric in that news than true news. So I don't know what the path will be there.
Well, I think what you're seeing is an injection of actual disinformation.
Certainly.
Because it isn't really ideological. When you use ideological rhetoric to mask what you're really doing, like when you see Bush get up and use the word freedom and independence and, you know, autonomy 19 times in an address, then, and you know what he's really about, that clearly has nothing to do with the words that are being used. You could probably actually have to translate what he's saying, because he's saying something completely different. What does the word independence and freedom mean to George Bush?
Well, and I think there's a lot of people out there that have proposed various Bush to English dictionaries.
Yes.
But
you bring up an interesting question. What can we do? And the Republican Liberty Caucus, I'm sure, has been looking at things that it can do within the Republican Party and things that the public can do to change the dialogue.
Certainly. And I think the greatest thing we can do is first of all, is be willing to disagree. It's unfortunate that Republicans tend to overquote the what's called Reagan's 11th Commandment, the idea that you don't go after other Republicans. But I think that there are times when we do have to say, look, I disagree with what you're saying. I disagree passionately. Here's why I believe you are wrong. And if we can't discuss this in a civil format that reaches a conclusion, then perhaps we're going to have to do this in a way that's that's less civil and more shouting. I don't know what it takes, but we have to be willing to disagree with ourselves. And that's the first step, and that's what people are the Republican Liberty Caucus is good for, is because we are willing to disagree with the Republican leadership. There are a number of issues. It's been most obvious in the past on the social issues, but over the past few years, we've seen the Republican Liberty Caucus passionately disagreeing with the Republican Party on economics issues, mm-hmm. which is rare because we are very conservative on economics issues, which basically goes to show that the National Republican Party has become less conservative on economics issues.
Well, I don't think they were ever conservative at all. In terms of what their actions were, they're rhetorically they used the words, but again, they didn't deliver the reality.
Well, I do believe back in the mid '90s, there was a clear effort on the part of the new Republican Congress to enact real conservative economic measures, and to a large extent, there was a lot of successes there, and the public agreed with it.
Well, the public certainly agreed that they wanted change. They were very unhappy with where they saw the country going before 94. But I don't think I've ever really been persuaded that the Republicans actually delivered. As a matter of fact, during that period of time, I heard the rhetoric and I was excited by the rhetoric because, of course, that was, you know, they were mirroring my beliefs. But I never saw any of those things really work out the way that they were supposed to.
And I think the other part of what we had there that was very positive was that that conflict with a Republican Congress and a Democrat president. But in this case, the conflict created a discussion, and that was very positive.
Mm-hmm.
To a large extent, that's why I almost wanted to see Bush lose in 06. If we had even as sorry of an excuse for a human being as John Kerry is, if he was put in the position of president, we would have seen a renewed vigor from a Republican Congress fighting him, and perhaps we could have created a dialogue at that point. But all we've had was an effort to appease what Bush intended to do.
Well, yes, and his intentions were very clear and obvious to many people already at that point. And, of course, now everybody's horrified because it looks like we're about to go into Iran. No more reason than we had to go into Iraq.
Well, I'm not terribly worried about that for the simple reason of we don't have the military manpower to do that. So it's I've said some harsh things about Bush, about how I'm criticizing his intellect, but I don't think that he's that dumb. And that really takes a complete lack of thought to think that invading Iran at this point is something that would have any positive fruit.
Well, you know, that's true, except that he has continued to promote the idea of the surge.
Well,
he hasn't backed off. As far as I know, we're still, mounting, what looks like it could be a force for attack right off the shore there.
The surge really is nothing more than, in gambling terms, doubling down. Or increasing your bet. Even though you know you don't have a winning hand, you've just got to keep doubling down in order to try and make up for your past losses. And I think I'm not a heavy gambler myself, but I think anybody who has been a heavy gambler, especially people who have been through all that and ended up in Gamblers Anonymous, recognize that that policy doesn't work. If you keep trying to do what you're doing when you've been failing, you're going to continue to fail.
That's true.
So,
I haven't found a lot of rationality in the Bush presidency, so it certainly leaves these questions open. Now, actually, the Conservative Times, I think it's very indicative, just called, just has a statement up now on, to impeach George Bush. And let me just read this. It has posted under politics, is it time to impeach Bush and Cheney on the following charges. One, escalating without the consent of Congress the illegal neocon war in Iraq. Two, treasonously supporting the third world invasion of the United States. And three, undermining judicial procedure and justice in the Ramos-Compian case. I think it's high time, even if it means putting Nancy Pelosi in the White House. And to be honest, having Pelosi in the White House for 2 years will put conservatives in a better position in 2008. And, of course, New Mexico just passed a Bush-Cheney impeachment resolution. That happened this afternoon. So the dialogue is changing rapidly, with this appearing in what is definitely a conservative publication.
Well, even though I might, and I do, disagree with the grounds that that publication offers, and I agree that the most important thing here is the dialogue. I think that we do have to get people talking about what went wrong before we can get to the conclusion of what we need to do to make everything right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this has been – oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I think that even people who disagree with the idea of impeachment, disagree with impeaching the president – have to really come to the conclusion that we do need to discuss this. Closing down debate on these issues really doesn't do us any good.
Well, no, it doesn't. And certainly it's something that, since it's being discussed very widely, needs to be discussed amongst Republicans.
Certainly.
And it would be very nice to see that happen. Now, your organization, Republican Liberty Caucus, actually is in a position to help make that happen.
Certainly. I don't see the RLC taking an official stance in supporting impeachment. However, I mean, it's clear that is something that a lot of the members and even a lot of the leadership within RLC agrees with.
Mm-hmm.
We can't look at Bush. The problem is that a lot of Republicans look at Bush and say, well, he's one of ours. The problem is that a lot of and we do have to recognize that while he's got an R after his name, he really isn't one of us. He hasn't done anything that we should really be terribly proud of. So as such, allowing this discussion to happen brings these issues up and allows us to say, have these issues been issues that we can agree on? Maybe there are some. Maybe there are some issues that we can look at and say that this is something that that he has done that we agree on, and it's something that has to be continued. But a lot of the issues, we're going to come out and say, look, this is something that never should have happened in the first place. Bush should never have proposed it. The legislature should never have adopted it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a dialogue that is extremely late in coming, and it should have happened a long time ago.
Well, absolutely. And I'm sure that the whole idea of starting this is like seeing this, in this conservative publication. When these things start to happen, I think it's going to happen very rapidly, that Republicans move to the point where they're very, very anxious to discuss it, because there must be a tremendous level of anger there given the tremendous fear that's existed within the Republican Party, as you cited earlier.
Yes, and now that we start seeing more and more Republicans willing to discuss it, the people that were just basically sitting on the sidelines and accepting that, well, he's our president, those people might be more and more willing to make their voices heard about, even if they say that they don't support impeachment. They could say, and I've been supporting Bush for all this time, but, I really disagree with him on this. And that's good. Not the fact that there's conflict within the Republican Party, that in itself isn't good, but the fact that we are now getting to the point where we can look forward to a legitimate discussion of the issues of what it means to be a Republican. And
mm-hmm.
we haven't had that discussion in a long time.
And that is such an important thing. What does it mean to be a Republican? And I think that many of us have sort of lost our sense of confidence that it has any meaning that's positive at all. And that's
right.
A really sad thing, given the wonderful history of the Republican Party in terms of what it's accomplished in terms of social justice over the years.
Well, I remember way back in my college Republican days, there was this little card that we used to give out that said at the top, "I am a Republican because." And it had this the series of beliefs, and it was all about the individual issues and about why people can do things themselves quite well. And I haven't seen that card in quite a while. Actually, I just typed it into a Google search here, and it pops right up on the website of the Republican Party page of Florida.
Well, that's you should go download them and print them for the Republican Liberty Caucus.
Certainly, certainly. But the idea is that this hasn't been what it's what it means to be a Republican in quite a while. And I think that at the point at which we are disagreeing sets the groundwork to eventually have somebody state that and make that the important part of the discussion. What does it mean to be a Republican? And if we can start that discussion, then I think we're all going to be better off for it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I can see that. And could you, you're, of course, a representative. You're state chairman of the Republican Liberty Caucus. Could you let people know how to get a hold of you if they want to join and become active or find out more about it?
Certainly. The National Republican Liberty Caucus website, very easy to remember, rlc.org.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it's we got lucky, got that one early. And for the states, your individual states, you can find out about just by going to, for California, it's ca.rlc.org. For whatever state your listeners might be in, just type in their state abbreviation, .rlc.org. And that's it. That's how you get to it. It has the contact information for who in your state you should get in touch with to get involved in the Republican Liberty Caucus. It's and the organization is ready for people to come in and say, hey, this is what I believe in. I want to be a part.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a wonderful thing to see because it then begins a dialogue on not only what the Republican Party is but what it should be. And then that takes you into so many other issues about being an American.
Absolutely. We've got the most important dialogue is on the horizon. It is coming. And we're just a couple years out from the presidential election, and we have a responsibility to create this dialogue. And if people want that to happen, then they can get involved right now.
Well, and I certainly hope a lot of people do. Well, Doug, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Melinda.
It's been great, and you take care, and you have a wonderful weekend.
Okay, you too.
Okay, night.
Good night.
And that's our show for today, Friday, February 16th, 2007. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find ways to bring government into alignment with the way we know we should be treating others personally, in business, and at every other point in our lives, using all the tools we as humans devise, including political parties. Political parties also have to do the right thing. Freedom in doing the right thing matters more than winning because the bottom line is loving each other as Christ loves each of us. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.